Welcome to The Elephant, made with the support of the Climate Kick Alumni Association.
The alternative to hypocrisy is not moral purity. The alternative to hypocrisy is cynicism.
That's my guest today, George Monbiot, a journalist and weekly columnist for The Guardian newspaper. He's one of the foremost progressive thinkers in Britain today. In his writings, he takes on a range of social and political topics, but he's probably best known for his work tackling environmental issues. He's authored several books, including Heat, How to Stop the Planet Burning, a 2006 book on climate change. Most recently, he's written Feral, a book where he talks about the potential of rewilding or reintroducing species that have been wiped out from their former habitats. In his columns, Monbiot often draws the connections between how the environmental and climate crises we're facing are intimately interconnected with other traits of our society. For example, the enormous concentration of corporate power.
It is by far and away the greatest threat to democracy, and because it's a threat to democracy, it's a threat to the survival of human civilization and much of the rest of life on this planet.
Or the runaway consumerism that has us gripped.
You know, these are not essential components of human happiness we're talking about here, but they are essential components of economic growth.
In our conversation, we also talk about what would happen if governments actually did walk the talk on climate change, and why they're so reluctant to do so.
This would be basically a straightforward contest for survival between fossil fuel companies and governments, and it's not totally clear to me which one would win.
And we also talk about why, in his view, the root cause of climate change goes well beyond capitalism.
You know, we say, well, it's this particular system that we're in which is the problem. It's not. It's a lot deeper than that. And I'm slightly worried that we end up misframing it.
That's George Monbiot. So let's get right to it.
Hey, Kevin.
Hi, George.
Yes, that's me. How are you doing?
Good. And you?
Yes, I'm fine.
You know, I wanted to start off by asking you about the Guardian's campaign, or at least about the idea that I think they've really done a great job in spreading in terms of leaving it in the ground, leaving fossil fuels in the ground as the main challenge that we need to do in staving off the climate crisis. Now, I thought this was a new way to think about climate change, more or less, like through Bill McKibben and 350.org, the people who've been working on this. I thought it was relatively new, but I was surprised to find out when I was researching that you actually first coined this term way back in 2007. Can you talk to me a bit about how your evolution to that thinking came to be? Because before, the focus, I think, of the entire environmental movement was on just individuals reducing their consumption.
Yeah. Well, I had just published a whole book about how to tackle greenhouse gas emissions and to get a 90% cut in emissions while maintaining a reasonable quality of life in the developed nations, a book called Heat. And it wasn't until a few months after that, in 2007, when I started working with people campaigning against open cast coal mines here in Britain, that it suddenly hit me with tremendous force that we were missing something huge here, something which should have been obvious from the outset, but because of the way the problem was framed, even I, who had just spent 3 years working on the issue, had completely missed it, which is that we were talking entirely about our consumption of fossil fuels without talking about the production of fossil fuels. And that if you attempt to deal with a problem only at one end, only at the demand end rather than the supply end, you are almost certain to fail because the supply end will continue to undermine the demand end. And this is especially the case with climate change, where the measures we deploy to try to reduce our emissions tend to be weak and negotiable, whereas the extraction of fossil fuels from the ground is a hard fact. That is a non-negotiable fact. And when they have been extracted, they will be burnt, regardless of what those weak and negotiable measures might say. So unless you restrain the extraction, you are not going to solve the problem. And this came to me when I was sitting on top of an enormous machine. A bunch of us had swarmed into an open cast coal mine, which was just being started. It was going to be the biggest active mine in Britain. It was strongly opposed by local people. it was going to make a substantial contribution to undermining our country's own carbon targets. So we decided to try to stop the work. It's in a symbolic way. Obviously, we weren't going to be able to stop the whole operation, but to close it down for a day.
So you were basically breaking in and trying to get in the way.
Yeah, well, we climbed onto these huge extraction machines to stop them from working, which we did successfully. And it was sitting on top of one of these things. I was thinking, unless this stops, everything I've just written in my book is a complete waste of time. So why is all the focus on changing light bulbs and having more efficient means of transport and stuff, and not on what I'm seeing right here under my feet, which is the coal being extracted from the ground in the first place? And so suddenly it hit me, and I wrote this article saying, look, I have the answer. I've found this fail-safe means of carbon capture and storage, which is called leaving fossil fuels in the ground.
What do you think? I mean, it's such an obvious point once you actually think about it. And I mean, it seems strange that it wasn't framed in those terms in a way. Why do you think we missed this point earlier?
Well, you use the term framed, and you're quite right to do so. And the frames, the mental structures through which we perceive the world, are absolutely crucial in determining the limits of that perception, in telling us what is there to be seen and what exists outside the box which is not to be seen. And we talk of blind spots, things that we don't see as a society, but we don't really have blind spots. We have tiny vision spots, tiny spots of perception in what is basically darkness. And those are the spots where a flashlight has been shone on a particular issue and a particular way of looking at that issue. And we all focus on that. We all look at where the light is, and we look at the thing that it illuminates, and we fail to see everything that surrounds it.
I guess it's like how a magician's trick works.
That's exactly it. And what magicians are so great at is framing, is saying, look over here. This is what I want you to see, and this is the way in which I want you to see it. And so we all see it, and we all look without even knowing that we're being induced to do so. And we don't see all the shenanigans which are going on somewhere which is right there in front of us, but we don't see it because of what we've been induced to see. And this is the way the whole issue was framed from the very beginning of the process. So if you go back to the Rio Earth Summit in 1992, it's all about greenhouse gas emissions, and it's not about coal and oil and gas and leaving them in the ground. And I think it wasn't necessarily with bad intent. I think what had happened was that they were riding on the success of the Montreal Protocol, which dealt with the CFCs and the other chemicals which were damaging the ozone layer. And they thought, oh, well, that's a way to go. You know, we just stop producing those gases. And so they said, all right, we've got to stop producing greenhouse gases now to deal with climate change. But of course, the thing with CFCs is that by stopping manufacturing the gases, you were stopping producing the gases. It was kind of all of one issue. But in this case, it's a two-step process. You dig the fossil fuels out of the ground, then you burn them. And there's two separate processes going on there. And if all we're talking about is the burning of them, we are not going to deal with the issue.
One of the, I think, great points you make is comparing this to past struggles that we've had, like slavery or the arms trade. If we were to try to, you know, solve the international arms trade, not at the producing end, but at the consumption end.
Yes, I think I used the example of the Biological Weapons Protocol, which, you know, prevents states from using weaponized anthrax or smallpox or all of these horrible things which they might otherwise be induced to use. And if that were to say, there are no restrictions on stockpiling weaponized anthrax and weaponized smallpox, it's just that we don't want you to use them. Well, how effective do we think that would be? You know, if you had 50 states, each with a massive stockpile of these really unpleasant weapons, and you have a situation like Syria at the moment, do you really think they're not going to use them if they've got them? The only way that the protocol is effective is that it forbids both their use and their ownership. It forbids having them in the first place. So it's the production and the consumption which are both banned. You're not allowed to make them. You're not allowed to store them. You're not allowed to use them. But in this case, we are allowed to we're allowed to dig the fossil fuels out, so we're kind of making them. We are allowed to store them, but we're trying to prevent them being used. It's just not going to work. And if you want a good example of how that sort of thing doesn't work, well, look at the US gun laws. You know, you can all have guns. Hey, folks, you can all have guns, just don't use them. If you use them, you're going to go to prison. Well, if everyone's got guns, they're going to get used.
I want to come back to kind of the cognitive dissonance that represents in a second. But first, I just wanted to have you comment on something that I think was a really big problem with the previous framing, which was that by necessity, if you had any concern at all, even if you did all you could to reduce your emissions, you were still a hypocrite. You couldn't possibly not be a hypocrite because we still live in the world. We still, you know, function as a human in Western civilization. I saw this one interview you did after the release of your book in 2007. It was on a Canadian public broadcaster in Ontario. And the interview was okay, but the focus the whole time was on how you had flown there and how, you know, hence that was part of the problem. Could you just comment about that?